And so, you know, what you feel and the where you sort of fit in is, from a pastoral perspective, a much secondary concern than where you actually being fed, with word and sacrament are rightly and duly administered.
Welcome to the Stand Firm Podcast. We're recording this episode on Tuesday, September 9th, 2025. I'm Nick Lannon of Grace Anglican Church in Louisville, Kentucky, and I'm here as usual with Matt Kennedy of the Anglican Church of the Good Shepherd in Binghamton, New York, and J.D. Koch of Holy Trinity Parish in Hillsdale, Michigan. Gentlemen, how are you doing today?
Great. How are you?
Great.
I'm doing all right. Well. Thanks for asking. J.D., you are now officially installed as rector of Holy Trinity. How was the service?
It was great. It was very illustrative of a given Sunday, and I felt a little bit for Bishop Mark, although I'm sure he is used to this. But there was, you know, a bunch of kids, a bunch of noise. I tried to listen to the sermon. I was trying to keep two boys from crawling under the pew, you know, like grabbing people's leg the whole time. So, but it was great. It was glorious. We had a good contingent from around the diocese, even though it's non-geographic. It was sweet to see people come in, drive a little bit, to come through. And, it was wonderful. It was quite a weekend, because me and my son John woke up Saturday, assuming it was Monday. And I was like, sorry, son, we got to get back to church tomorrow. Aren't you glad your dad's a priest? But no, it was sweet. It was meaningful and touching, and, you know, I mean, it's all the things, if you've ever had the opportunity, you know, I think short of wedding vows, I mean, you know, and obviously it's not even remotely as solemn, nevertheless, short of that, I think there's pretty much as profound a kind of promise and public oath you can take, you know, and so it's meaningful. And I was, so there we go. So it was good and done, and did my first east facing 28 prayer book service, which was great. Actually, I was touched. It wasn't, it, you know, I mean, you get past your sort of jitters just for something new, but but I mean, it was communion. I mean, it wasn't so different that I didn't know where I was, but but I did actually appreciate, and I don't know, we could maybe have a whole thing on this. I do think that, as far as the prayer book rubrics go, it is very clergy centric. There's a lot that has been, for better or worse, farmed out to lay people, you know, in the 79, and then obviously 19. Even insofar as like the prayers of the people, for instance, you know, I'm not used to doing, used to kneeling and listening to someone do the prayers, and then, you know, inviting the confession, and then doing the comfortable words, but really not taking over until the sursum corda. But this is that whole section before, as you probably know, I just really hadn't paid attention, is at least here, is clergy led. And so I, by the end of the second service even, I was like, well, this has been a lot of
lozenge.
That's right. But I it was great. It was touching and meaningful and all the things. And so now we're really just kind of you know, spreading out, and just still praying. If our listener prays, we have some people still looking at our house in Hilton Head, so that'll be a big milestone. You know, when that's sold, then we can really finally just close the door for all the great things that happened there, but really just settle in. So yeah, thanks for your prayers, and we can watch it. I don't know why you may want to, but it's on the interwebs. It was good. Bishop Mark came, and Bishop Dobbs were there. So we had all of them in place, and did all the oaths and all the prayers, and signed all the things. And we're as official as you can get at this point.
Very cool.
Yeah.
Our topic today comes to us from Twitter, or X, as they so often do. Hannah King of ACNA fame posted this on Monday. She writes, "What if we were happier to release people into other Christian traditions? I've known plenty whose faith was preserved because they were burned out on church and caught," she puts that in quotes, "caught by something new to them, liturgy/sacraments, or maybe guitars/community groups. What do you all make of this, the idea of changing churches or church traditions? Are there good and bad reasons to do that? And what about as pastors being happy, quote unquote, to release people into other churches?
Can you put some context to that first, Nick or Matt? Do you want to? Because it wasn't just, she didn't just like decide to tweet
Yeah,
about that this week.
there is
I
some
was.
underlying stuff, sure. Why don't you go ahead, Matt?
Right. Well, she wrote an article. It was 2 years ago, 3 years ago, maybe longer than that.
I think it was longer than that.
Yeah, Why Can't We Be Friends? I think was
It's evergreen, though. It's
the
evergreen.
title of the article, explaining how the fresh faced younger clergy in the ACNA and the fresh faced younger clergy in the Episcopal Church could get past their cranky old boomer, angry Anglicans, and their and
Anglican, I
that's.
like it.
I was called an Anglican once because
Nice,
I didn't
I
want
like
to
it.
rejoin the Episcopal
What if I
Church.
could get a
But
personalized license plate with that somehow? What would that be in six characters or less?
the younger generation could make peace with the Episcopal
Wasn't that
Church.
about the time when the Duke we tried to find out who was the concelebrant
Yeah, there was a service
in
going
the
on.
Anglican whatever that place is in Duke? They had the service in between the Muslim calls to prayer, of course.
Well, right.
And
So,
the solstice labyrinth walking, right? Sorry.
it does beg the question of what she means by leaving for other traditions and what purposes or what reasons she would see as legitimate to go, because leaving the ACNA for the Episcopal Church is, in my view, unless you're going to one of the very few Orthodox congregations there, it's to commit apostasy. You're leaving. You're actually leaving not just the ACNA. You're actually leaving the body of Christ for something else, which of course I don't think she believes. So I mean, my first question would be, where are these people going and why? If it's because faith is languishing, or there's some kind of I forget how she phrased it. If a person in his or her own congregation is feeling burnt out,
Burnt out on church, yeah.
yeah, I just don't I don't think of that as a legitimate reason to hop to another church.
We also had the existence of the PCA guy who left this week. I mean, I think that's what the context she was writing, like the music director for some PCA church. I want to say in the DC area, or maybe, I don't know, somewhere. Gave a sermon which essentially was an apologetic for him leaving, and then he was feted and celebrated in his leaving, and then there was like a prayer, and then he ended up doing communion, ostensibly probably for the last time ever, at least in a church context, or at least for the foreseeable future. And there was a huge uproar about that all around Twitter, at least the people that I was following, particularly among the Reform, because they said, what, how did this happen? Who was on watch? Obviously, people come and go, but the way that he left, and then the lack of concern, if not outrage, from the leadership who should have otherwise been protecting the sheep from this, well, what many called apostasy, was all is still a topic of conversation all over the internet. I think that's what, in part, she was subtweeting also. So yeah, I think that's all part of the context of what that was coming through. Anyway, I didn't mean to interrupt you that exactly, but I think that was also the
Yeah, no, definitely.
part of the water.
Yeah, so I mean, I guess if you're, we've had people come to Good Shepherd, for example, who have had that, where they feel like they have not been given the rich heritage of tradition and liturgy in their own places, and so that they want to come to Good Shepherd to have that. And I think is a different kind of leaving. I'm theologically committed now to this form of worship where I wasn't before. Or if someone in an Anglican church were to say, "I think all this liturgy is terrible. I don't want to do it anymore. I think this is I'm theologically, I have a problem with this. I don't know if I can do it." You count talk with the person, counsel the person, but ultimately that is, and that's why we have different denominations actually, because there are some legitimate reasons why you can't worship in the same place anymore. But I don't think being burned out is one of those legitimate reasons.
And you would say that it was the pastor's prerogative to argue for the way that his church engages in worship. Like, it's not a bad thing to have a commitment or a conviction and then try to defend it.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, if someone, I've had people come to me and say they don't understand a liturgy, and I'll try to say, here's why do what we do, and I think it's a great thing and a biblical thing. And you know, many times the person has gone away persuaded, but other times
But you
there's
don't
not.
immediately hop on the phone and say, "Let's find you a new church
No, no,
that's
and
more
I would.
tailored to what you want
That's
today." Yeah.
right. I won't do that. They can do their own
That's
searching.
right. Are you an Enneagram 4 with a 7 wing? Well, then you really should go to this one. I mean, what a joke. No, I agree with you, Matt. I think that I mean, what we're witnessing here overall, I think, in you know this tweet and the guy leaving the PCA and the arguments all around it are bringing to the surface again, kind of the I would say the how thin most people's theological understanding of their own church from the pews are, if not even the ministers. And when we revert to almost exclusively pragmatic or, for lack of a better word, emotional appeals to or aesthetic appeals as to why you're in one church over another, you really have almost lost the plot from the beginning. I mean, the conversation is almost invalidated from the outset because you could have churches with a, you know, with a guitar and, you know, outside under a tree in Kenya that are more theologically sound and true churches than the most well than watching Lambeth, the last Lambeth conference with all of the pomp and circumstance of millennia of the English church. And so, you know, what you feel and the where you sort of fit in is from a pastoral perspective, a much secondary concern than where are you actually being fed, you know, where word and sacrament are rightly and duly administered, you know, where you're a part of a true church. Now, there are more than I wouldn't, Dane, maybe we could argue, but I wouldn't say the Anglican Church is the only true church. But we recognize in our 39 articles that other true churches have erred, you know, and that there are errors that persist. And so I'm happy to remain, you know, that we're a mere Protestant. I mean, it's not, it doesn't, you know, I still protest the errors of like, for instance, Roman Catholic Church and the Orthodox we've talked about, and even our own church, you know, still protesting, hoping it'll be reformed and brought more in line to scripture, both personally and corporately. But the idea that somehow someone could come to you and just sort of, quote, feel burned out or not getting it anymore or somehow not, you know, it's just not working for them, and that you facilitate their search for some other type of church. I mean, you know, I know people that have had much more kind of spiritual, transcendent experiences on Soul Cycle with Coldplay, you know, than they have in many, many church services, or at least on a regular basis. And it's like, you know, and I taught Cycle Bar for a while. We can really manipulate you pretty easily. You start throwing in, you know, what's that song? Nobody said it was easy, but nobody said it would be that hard. You know that
Oh,
song, like, makes
yeah.
everyone cry? You just turn all the lights off, put that in about 45 minutes into exhausting yourself, and like only the most hardened Navy SEAL who's been prepared against psychological warfare will not be broken down. And so it's like, if that's what we're into, if that's what you're looking for, well, then we got all sorts of things we could call church. But if you're looking for a biblically faithful proclamation where the gifts of God for the people of God are duly and rightly administered, well, then we've got a lot more to talk about than how you feel at the moment. And I think that's what the conviction that many ministers have lost, obviously, clearly in this PCA church, that they let the guy go to Rome without a fight, or at least by celebrating
And
him. And
Madden
I
preached a
think
sermon about it. I mean, that's
right
right.
after celebrating at the table, right after preaching that sermon.
Nothing I'm doing here means anything at all, but I hope that you all sort of appreciate how beautifully meaningful I think it is to me. But I think that's what we see again in Anglicanism. I mean, again, and I'm, you know, and I, we've all been on this journey together these decades now. But the number of people that I meet who have come to Anglicanism for I wouldn't say atheological, because I don't think aesthetics or beauty are atheological exactly, but that their leading edge is, I felt that it was more meaningful or historic, which, you know, I think, okay, well, tell me more. And it's almost, well, in many cases, that's about as far as it goes, you know. And so I said, well, you know, that's a good place to start, and I agree with you. But we need to ground that, because, you know, you're going to be in a situation where, you know, bigger, flashier, more emotive is going to be a possibility for all sorts of things, not the least of which church. You know, there's all sorts of things you can do on a Sunday morning that can, you know, commune with the divine, if you will, you know. But you need to go to church. You need to go to real church, like a one that's been established by the Word of God, and ministers have been duly trained and ordained and sent to to give you the means of grace for the hope of glory. And so that's not every church. And so I think we need to be much more discerning, particularly as ministers, than perhaps some people have been.
Yeah, not just the discerning about the what where is this person going, what kind of experience or worship is this person looking for, but also just read when you read the New Testament, the emphasis on maintaining unity, not just with like the invisible church, but with the actual local congregation is strong. I mean, as you were talking, I pulled up Ephesians 4. I, therefore, a prisoner for the Lord, urge you to walk in a manner worthy of the calling to which you've been called, with all humility and gentleness and patience, bearing with one another in love, eager to maintain the unity of the Spirit and the bond of peace. And there is one body, one Spirit, just as you were called to one hope that belongs to your call, one Lord, one faith, one baptism, one God and Father of all. So Paul there is saying to people in local congregations, God has joined you guys together. He's put you in that particular place with those particular people. And so the eagerness should not be, do I need to go find somewhere else now that I'm not feeling all the ways I should feel? But how can I maintain the bond of peace and maintain the unity of the spirit with these people who God has set me into? And I think it's kind of lost. I'm not sure. We talked about before the consumerist mentality that drove the seeker sensitive movement, and of course that's endemic in our society as a whole. Am I being entertained? Am I happy? How do I feel at this particular moment? I mean, constantly taking my emotional temperature and checking in looking in at my navel, see if it's all right. I mean, that's part of our cultural inheritance, I guess. But it's antithetical to what the New Testament calls Christians to be and do within a congregation. Maybe the first place I would want to start with someone who's just burnt out, I guess, is the word that she used, or the phrase that she used is there. I mean, look, you have a before you go anywhere, you have a responsibility given to you by the apostle, and that means by Jesus, to eagerly seek to maintain unity here with your local congregation. So what are you doing on that score?
I'm curious to know what you guys think about how this works out, even within a Christian tradition like the ACNA. We find ourselves in a denomination that calls us to, and I know that, the issue of women's orders is sort of the rub in the ACNA, and our tradition calls us to honor and respect people who disagree with us on that issue. That's why we have different diocesan positions. But I think that this kind of thing can, in a sense, rear its head within the ACNA too, whether from one side or the other. If there was a woman in a more complementarian diocese who expressed a felt call to be ordained as a presbyter, what should her leadership do? Should they, quote, be happy to release her into another diocese where she can live into the calling that she feels? Or do they have some obligation as her shepherd to at least try to teach her what they believe that the Bible teaches about this rather than sort of inviting her into what they think of as disobedience? How does that work even within our church?
Yeah, I mean it's not totally analogous to what's happening in the Episcopal Church with bishops who are required to, facilitate the same-sex unions or marriages, quote unquote, because like you say, this within the ACNA in any way, this is a contentious issue, but it is one in which we've said we're going to be in the same church together. However, that being said, I mean it is an important thing. It's not. I would put this in a level, not quite as high as if you disagree on this, you're not a Christian, but just below that, right? I mean, kind of below that one, because it does have to do with what is a man, what is a woman, what role, what is God and God's purpose,
Well,
and
it has to do with how did God reveal himself? What's the nature of the scriptures? What's epistemology? I mean, every ology out there, I mean, ontology, epistemology, entomology, anthropology, hamartiology. I mean, you just
All
start
the
going down the
ologies.
line. That's right. All the ologies are affected. So, sure, we can agree to disagree, but we will manifestly teach and, in fact, preach and live in dramatically different ways, albeit as it has been given to us. under one large tent. So yeah, I agree with you, Matt. It is it's almost of primary importance. It's bumping up against there.
Yeah, so it's not like okay, I don't agree with, having real wine at communion, so I'm gonna go to the church. This is a different thing. So I think
Although that's an interesting question, because you can really make an argument about that, actually.
I've had that before, but yeah, you need to have in that case, like if your convictions are really on either side of that question, I think in good conscience you need to argue the case out very strenuously, and I don't think you should help necessarily the person going to do the other thing, because for example, if you're Anglo Catholic and you think the sacraments are absolutely essential to salvation, and they're invalid if celebrated by a woman, which I agree with that part of it, then you're putting people into spiritual danger by facilitating the transfer that way. So I can see an Anglo Catholic just not being able to do it, or needing to really make the argument in a significant way. On the other side, I guess if you're convictionally egalitarian, I think you're sending someone away who is maybe part of the patriarchy or whatever, supportive of the patriarchy. I can see you might want to have a real, I don't know, that you'd want to facilitate the transfer,
Well, if you
just because
believe
people.
that
So
the
here's the
Bible is
question
teaching
then.
something, if you believe the Bible is teaching something, and somebody comes to you and says, "I believe the Bible is teaching something else," it seems incumbent upon you, if you actually believe the thing you claim to believe, to try to teach. If you're the elder, if you're the shepherd, that's your calling. Now, obviously, you're not going to like chain somebody to the wall and forbid them to leave your church. Ultimately, there's only so much you can do. But I think that if dual integrities has any meaning whatsoever, it's got to be that each person, to be faithful to their integrity, has to be willing and able to teach it and defend it, rather than just sort of putting their hands away and waving goodbye and wishing people well. Well, this is why it's, as we've talked about before, it's either a slow poison, which is what I think it is, or we can actually attempt to live into what we've been told is the compromise. The problem is when we actually try to live into that, like for instance, when we have a conference that's entirely based upon the difference between men and women and the biblical explication of that, we're immediately seen as divisive and perhaps hateful and onerous and seen askance with respect to the let's live and let live kind of mindset of the more moderate, quote unquote, moderate positions within the church. And so, that's been the challenge, is that like if you actually teach that there are errors, period. Like it is the Church of Rome hath erred. Like there is they like the Council of Trent, people literally were killed because they disagreed with some of the conjectures of the Roman Catholic Church. Like John Rogers, the first English martyr, the Marian martyr, Ridley, Latimer, Cranmer for that matter, and on down the line. And so you're just like, either you have to say, well, they were, took it a little too seriously, maybe they should have just pulled back a little bit and had some tea and and realized that we're all brothers from another mother, or they were right. I mean, and I don't want to say they were right in every single point exactly, but like that we've gotten to a situation in our culture which we're pushing back from, but we're our churches, the theology, I don't want to say it's downstream from culture, but it's a complicated relationship. But the fact that we have a generation of people that are cynical about claims to absolute truth, and that's manifesting in a sort of kind of amorphous understanding of a mere Christian kind of conviction, that if you have someone that's going to church and saying Jesus, then like we're sort of indifferent to a certain degree about whether or not, what church and what are they saying about him, and you see this, from the most egregious to people who are like, well, Mormons are pretty nice people, or all the way to well, I guess the like this PCA minister, like he was in whatever an ordained means in the PCA, ordained PCA pastor who's now becoming, has felt called into full communion with the Roman Catholic Church, and people are like, well, to each his own. It's like, well, we have a long, long history of people saying no. In fact, it's not to each his own. In fact, there are false shepherds. There are churches that have erred. There are egregious claims, and there are positions you can hold that are detrimental to not only the temporal but the eternal health of your soul. And so again, I'm not, obviously to qualify this, I have friends in Roman Catholic, friends that are Orthodox, and you have to always say this. It's like, I'm not interested in policing individual people exactly in before the judgment seat of God when they stand before Jesus. And I pray, that all that I mean, like I like the adage, I assume there'll be a lot more people there than I imagine. But when we talk about institutional claims, we talk about theological statements. We look at, particularly with respect to the Roman Catholic Church, the overreach of the doctrines of the Council of Trent, which have yet to be corrected or reversed. We have explicitly anti-biblical statements that have been enshrined in the theology of a church that people are going to leave to join. And you say, as a minister, Protestant notwithstanding, just as a biblically based minister, you say you do that at your own peril. You do that, knowingly. Like that's, again, and I don't want to get into the whole discussion about ignorance and complicity and who knows what and when and how you'll be judged more or less. I mean, I think that's a fool's errand, that sort of conjecture, line of conjecture. But nevertheless, I do think that someone who, knowing all of that, particularly as someone called to leadership, knowing all of that, it makes a conscious decision to change is in a is at least is practically speaking in a different category as a shepherd or a false shepherd than someone who's being led around. And I think that that's but it's the indifference to all of it that's really problematic, because I'm willing and happy to, as it were, to accept the baptisms and enjoy the Christian company of all sorts of different kind of manifestations, Article 20 type churches who disagree on all sorts of ways of being church, or even ways of working their salvation out. I mean, it's a lot different for a Reformed Baptist to sort of engage their life and family in church than it is a Reformed Anglican, for that matter. It's different. It looks different. Your rhythms are different. Seasons are different. Church discipline, church leadership is all different. But I wouldn't go so far as to say they've apostatized, or they're somehow living at odds with the clear teaching of Scripture. But that's a different conversation than joining, church bodies or quote unquote traditions that have embraced anti-biblical stances on things, and then just sort of shrugging your shoulders and saying, well, to each his own. I mean, I don't think, I mean, certainly as Anglicans, we don't have the freedom to do that. We don't, I mean, if we're gonna live into our patrimony at all, spotted with the blood of martyrs as it is, for not only centuries past, but current centuries, then we just don't have the freedom to do that. You can step outside of your ordination vows and say, none of this really matters, and we're just gonna kind of sing kumbaya and hope for the best. But if we're actually going to be leading people in any sort of self-conscious Anglican theological tradition and patrimony, then we have to stand up, at the very least, vocally against some of these innovations of other churches. And that's not just the Roman Catholic Church. That's, health, wealth, gospel. That's the, like sort of the radical Bethel Pentecostal types. That's the Joel Osteen types. I mean, that's all of them, and I think that's not something you do with from a haughty seat of the scoffer, but with humility and with gratitude for the people who have hammered this out, for millennia before, and we are standing on their shoulders and preaching along with them. So I don't know. I mean, it's a symptom of a broader cultural rot, but I think it's something that we have to be aware of and hopefully can, in some small way, help reverse.
I mean, this is also why it's really important, I think, for all Anglican parishes to teach Anglicanism. Like, not, I mean, Christianity first, right? Of course, we're Christians first, Anglican second. To the gospel is always first and front and center, and the scriptures are too. But like, why don't you take your congregation through the 39 articles
Right.
so often, right? Take them through the 66
Jerusalem
prayer book.
Declaration.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Teach them
The
what it
preface to
is.
the prayer book. Yeah, I mean, this
Exactly.
is, yeah.
Because I
I mean,
think
nobody knew the church fathers better than the reformers, or at least not at the time. I mean, that's the whole thing. Like Ad Fontes, the Northern Renaissance, these were the people who were suffused and newly rebaptized into the tradition that had been rediscovered within their lifetimes for the most part. And so, you want to learn about Origen and Athanasius and Cyril, go read some of the early reformers who actually were conversant with them in a way that, most of us could only hope to be. And talk to me about the Catholic Church, the true Catholic Church, And I agree with you, Matt, because if we, like we said before, I think we said like in our second podcast, if we just printed the distilled version of the claims of the Jerusalem Declaration and 39 articles on the front of every ACNA, leaflet, and then we'd all be better off for it. It's like in this church, abandon all pretension, ye who enter here. It's not Dante over hell, it's over the church. Here's what you have to believe if you are going to worship with us. And we believe it too. I just was rig I just I'm thankful for the Diocese of Living Word. I just had to go through this like really rigorous kind of examination process, which I was grateful for in a sense that I wasn't worried about doing it. It was a little time consuming, but I was like, well, goodness gracious, like if everyone who had to go to be deigned to be an Anglican priest had to make these confessions, swear these oaths, and explain themselves to this degree, like we would be in a lot better place. Defend your understanding of the 39 articles, explain why the Jerusalem Declaration is important, explain your beliefs about human sexuality and why this marriage is sanctity the sanctified and all these things. So I was like, well, this is inspiring me. I mean, this should be something that the vestry has to do in every church, much less the priest. And so I think, anyway, I think we're at a pivotal time in the history of North American Anglicanism, because we have a lot of people who've come in who are starting to realize what they actually joined. And we have leadership who have the opportunity to say, well, yes, in fact, that is what you joined. And here's what you're going to have to do to come into conformity to it. Or we're going to have, which sadly seems to be the case for some, is a lessening of some of these historic, I don't want to say qualifications, but well, historic qualifications, and just sort of say, you do you. And that's to your point, Nick. Like, well, if you don't want this diocese is known for being more rigorous than that one, you should go to that one. Like, this one believes that, left is right and right is left. You should go there if that's what you think. This one is more low church, or this one's more high church. And to a certain aesthetic degree, I don't really care about that. But if it gets into the theological waters, which it seems to be threatening, then I think we're in trouble. And we're just redoing, like, a lot of the continuing churches on X guys always say, just we're TEC 2.0. It's like, and I mean, we saw that in seminary. Like when Nick and I were in seminary, probably you too, Matt, like it was just what diocese do you want to join, which essentially was what church would you like to be a part of? Because it was like just a bunch of different churches underneath the same big top, and so hopefully that's not the case. Although we certainly have reason to be concerned that there is a trajectory out there. I'm not going to say that we're on it, but we're certainly not far from it.
Yeah, I think we've talked about it before that we're most basically a confederacy more than a communion. We're joined together because of our the lifeboats from the Episcopal Church are tied together, and that's kind of where we still are. We're just different.
We're running out of food right now, though. We're starting to wonder. We're like, which of you?
Well, so I mean, that's why it's great. I mean, look, if you're in one of these boats like we are, and the you and I are, and the Diocese of the Living Word, it's really great that Bishop Dobbs is strengthening
Amen.
our dependence on the formularies, our adherence to them, and really defining our identity well, so that we're at least this little portion of the ACNA, the people in it know why you're in it, and know why this church exists, and why it's good to be Anglican and not
Amen.
and not have. So the more people know that, and I'm speaking beyond our diocese, but the more people who have an idea of what Anglicanism is. What are its strengths? What the history is? The less people are going to have this kind of vanilla view of the ACNA or Anglicanism that is just kind of a way station for Catholic rite, right? And then that's where you get the people just headed through on the way to Orthodoxy or Rome. Look, these people have robes, looks Catholic to me, not quite Roman yet, but I can hang out here until I feel like I can, I've got the necessary separation from my Baptist roots to finally become a Roman. And so then you're kind of a way station. But if we have an identity as a distinctly Protestant expression with real clear differentiations from Rome, which we have in our articles, and from Orthodoxy and from the Radical Reformation. Like
That's right.
the articles are not just aimed at our dispute with the Roman Catholic Church, but also with the enthusiasts, as Luther would call them, with the Anabaptists and
That
others.
goat Esmer is one of my favorite. Listen, it's like you should just Google that. It's Luther at his best.
Well, but that's what, because we're someone said this, I think they're right. I mean, vanilla evangelicalism in the United States is you can draw a direct line from it to the Anabaptists. It's not generally something that derives from one of the magisterial reforming traditions. It's more radical reformation. So we have a there's a real big differentiation between us and our Baptist friends on the other, on one hand, or especially our charismatic Pentecostal friends on the other. Anglicanism has a unique character and a reason that we don't employ these things. That's another, I'm going to beat another drum here, but this is why the Three Streams movement was such a, I think, a terrible thing, because it tended to dilute our distinctives. And so, especially with when you add the charismatic wing to it, it takes something that really wasn't ever part of historic Anglicanism and injects it. And then if you go to a church that really did hop onto the charismatic movement, some of them, it's very hard to see any distinctive Anglican element to it. What the biggest ACNA church now in our whole denomination is Vintage Church, is that what it's called?
I think so, yeah.
And I think if you've watched the service, you can't tell what
I think I watched
they're
one.
doing.
They did do the piece, but that there was
Okay.
not a confession beforehand. As far, I mean,
Okay.
I was watching it fast, so
But they don't
I
wear
don't.
vestments. They don't do any of this. I mean, do they have a liturgical form besides the piece? I can't, not that I remember.
No,
Yeah.
I didn't. I mean, if our listener goes to that church, then they could please call in and correct us if we're wrong. But no, I mean, I think this is the whole. This is again, we're downstream of the postmodern turn, which began to question all, as it were, meta narratives and claims absolute truth. And there's all sorts of historical reasons why we're downstream of that. But in that water, the church of all things, should be the place where we are anchored and where we could stand up against the this sort of this kind of cynical appeal to, I want to say pluralism in sort of a non-convictional way, which essentially says, like your three streams, Matt, like these are distinctions without differences, I mean, differences without distinctions, like it's you do you. You want to be an Anglo-Catholic, that's fine. You want to be a evangelical, that's fine. That's just how you're sort of wired, or your personality, or your personal convictions. But that's not the level of discussion or debate or dialogue that led people to the stake, back in the 16th century. I mean, that's not how we were talking about things. I mean, I think overall, I think that what's been lost, and again, I don't know how to reinsert this other than to preach, is that the actual awesome fear of God and his holiness and the prospect of eternity away from him and the actual questions of judgment and heaven and hell, like these things are what's underlying our understanding of churchmanship and our proclamation and our subscriptions to various theological things. And so, like I was listening to a podcast that was actually talking about the PCA guy, and one of the commentators was just referencing, I mean, Roman Catholic Church hasn't let go of its belief not only in purgatory but indulgences. And so, like, you're playing around with something that not only theoretically but as far as we know has eternal consequence for your soul, and you're just cavalierly saying, well, it's prettier, or it makes me feel better. And it's like, if you actually look at post-Vatican II, a lot of Roman Catholic churches, like, I mean, aesthetic brilliance is not what really stands out, you know. And so I would, so again, I think that what we're trying to just, we're humbly trying to hold on to is the patrimony we've received, the humility that comes from not creating something that you have been given stewardship and shepherding over, and just simply questioning when people within that stream seem to treat it cavalierly, if not with indifference. And I think that that's just a fair conversation to have, whether it was is respect to, you know, particular theological issues like women's ordination, all the way to bigger ones like churchmanship and sacraments and ordination and all sorts of things. And so, I don't know. I mean, I'm sure we're Anglicans, you know, we'll just continue to be the curmudgeons who want to be dogmatic instead of promote unity and all the things that we've heard. But it's been my personal experience, and I can even speak to my recent one within the Diocese of Living Word, that like truth is the basis for unity, and a shared convictions actually sheds forth an amazing sense of brotherhood and sisterhood and commonality across incredibly wide socioeconomic and otherwise cultural diversity. And that's the unifying proof and our promise of the gospel, which we see from Corinth to Galatia to Colossia all the way down to today. And the idea somehow along the way was that truth should be subsumed to this superficial emotive unity, which, as we've seen, when push comes to shove, even when it's something as ridiculous as like sportsmanship, sports teams, you know, affinity, is incredibly brittle and easily broken. Whereas unified profession of faith in Christ along a similar shared sense of conviction and confession is a bond that cannot be broken and won't be. And so that's what we're contending for, whatever organ or guitar you have in your church.
I mean, we should, less people think we're totally non-ecumenical. We should probably say,
Our
I mean,
listeners more gracious than that? Because we're not.
I want our Baptist listeners to be to do to study and know their tradition, the Baptist tradition, and I want our Presbyterian listeners to do the same thing. I want them to. I want each tradition to be strong in its own history. Because this is like the same thing with interfaith dialogue. You can't have an interfaith dialogue with a liberal Muslim. A liberal Muslim and a liberal Christian talking together is like, well, it's like vanilla ice cream. You don't get any, you don't really have a conversation across the divide. You don't have any conversation at all. It's just a bunch of agreement about how bad the conservatives are. But when you have a really Orthodox Muslim and an Orthodox Christian speaking together, then you can have a real actual dialogue because you're actually discussing the things that differentiate you. Now, ecumenical isn't the same thing. Other denominations are Christians, but you need to have strong fences so that you can have an actual conversation. Why are you Presbyterian and why am I Anglican? Let's talk about that and see which one fits the scriptures better. You can have an actual dialogue that way rather than just, oh, it doesn't matter. These are all just traditions in the past and we can just hop from one place to the next. So I think they're good. It's good to encourage every tradition to be strong so that when we as Anglicans compare ours to theirs, they'll all see that ours is the best and they'll all convert to Anglicanism.
That
That's
is
why we
meat and
started
right,
this
so to say.
podcast. Yeah. Well, those are good words to end on. That is all the time that we have today. Thank you for listening to Stand Firm this week. If you want to keep the conversation going, be in touch with us, become Anglican, join us. Rate and review the podcast on iTunes, send us an email at mailbag@standfirminfaith.com, or join the Anglicans for the Gospel Facebook group. Thanks to JD Koch and Matt Kennedy. I'm Nick Lannon, and Lord willing, we'll be back next week. Until then, by the grace of God and Jesus Christ, we'll be standing firm.